Welcome to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. I'm Judy Getty, and I'll be hosting the show today as we discuss Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. My guests are Melissa Benke and Judy Donegan. Welcome, and thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. Okay, so this book, the story unfolds in a graveyard over the course of a single night. It's narrated by a dazzling chorus of voices. It's February 1862. The Civil War is less than 1 year old. The fighting has begun in earnest, and the nation has begun to realize it is in for a long, bloody struggle. Meanwhile, President Lincoln's beloved 11-year-old son, Willie, lies upstairs in the White House gravely ill. In a matter of days, despite predictions of a recovery, Willie dies and is laid to rest in a Georgetown cemetery. "My poor boy, he was too good for this earth," the president says at the time. "God has called him home." Newspapers report that a grief-stricken Lincoln returned to the crypt several times alone to hold his boy's body. So that's kind of the gist of the lead-in to the story, I guess you would say, because the actual tale will take some other turns, and we'll be talking about that. But I wanted to start out with, after I'd read the book, I looked up some different reviews and of course was exposed to the book, so saw that there had been a lot of conversations about around the format of the book. Some people described it as being written like a play because of those different voices. Some people said that was confusing because rather than like in a script where it would have the name and then what the person said in the book, it has what the person says and then their name. And then I saw some comments on Goodreads from several people about reading the book and listening to it simultaneously. And so that is actually what I ended up doing. So I just wanted to know, what were your experiences in managing the way the book was formatted, and if you read and or listened?
Well, I just read it, and I did find it confusing at the beginning, just because it was so unusual, and I wasn't sure who was speaking or what was going on. It took me a while to figure out at all what the plot was going to be, but later on I decided it was just absolutely brilliant. I loved it.
And you stuck with it. Some of the other comments, people said, "Oh, this is terrible. I don't like this style. I don't like this avant-garde kind of writing." So some people abandoned it because it is so different.
Right.
I read it rather quickly, I think, and I liked it. I didn't find anything particularly, well, I think it's a little ambiguous a lot of times about what's going on, but I'm not sure that's due to the format. But then I'd heard so much about how great the audiobook was, the 164 voices, including famous people. So I never, ever have listened to an audiobook. So I thought I'd give it a shot. So I did partly what you did, Judy. Listened to the audio, and then followed along in the book a little bit. After a while, I was sort of just listening while I was doing dishes. But I was wondering on the audiobook, if you just listened to that, how you would keep track of who was speaking. Because the main speakers, all of the character speakers from the cemetery, are only identified the first time they speak. So I think without the book, I would have had a lot of trouble knowing exactly who was saying what. But I'd hate to go on here, but I didn't compare it so much to a play as it reminded me of a Ken Burns documentary, in the sense that you have a lot of talking heads giving the story, and they're not always identified right away either. The scroll often comes a little later. So I think that would have been what I would have compared it to. It's different. You don't have Peter Coyote as the main narrator in this situation. The narration comes through the characters. There is no other narration, which is a little unusual. But I found it surprisingly interesting. And I don't do stories of the supernatural or ghost stories I equate with summer camp. Mm-hmm. So I was surprised. I liked it.
Yes, I agree with everything you said about, you know, if you only listen to the book, because and it was very odd. I've never listened and followed along in a book before, so that was a different experience. And they really do complement each other for keeping you kind of like, oh, that's who's talking now, or that's what that person's story would sound like. So, yeah, I enjoyed the experience of doing both.
I might go back and get the audio book. You guys have sort of got me intrigued about that. And realizing that as I read the book, at times, because I did know that you were listening to it, Judy, I did sort of try to imagine what their voices must sound like or who, what well-known person was reading each character. And I did very much feel like it was a play, written like a play, because I kept thinking of the play Our Town.
Right.
Very similar to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has a lot of, I mean, people are saying how unique this is, I guess, but it does have a lot of precursors like Our Town and the Spoon River Anthology and various things like that, where the dead talk.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to bring up another technique because I think this is especially pertinent in our day of fake news being screamed at us. But Saunders decided to invent some of his sources and use real sources. And, I mean, I'm not historically, I don't have enough of a historical background to know which was which.
Right.
Yeah, me either. I really didn't care. I mean, you know Doris Kearns Goodwin mm-hmm. when you see her name, but I don't have enough background to know any of the others, and a lot of them were like letters from obscure people who might or might not be alive. But this is historical fiction. So, and I read something, an interview with Saunders, where he said that he worked really, really hard to try to make the ones he made up sound authentic and not pretentious and not like something he would have written, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. That didn't bother me. Is it supposed to?
It only bothers me because in another book club, we read the book The Underground Railroad by mm-hmm. Colson Whitehead. And some comments from other people in the group was that they feared that when people who don't know history at all read that, will think, oh, there really was a train underground. And so that when people read, even if they know it's fiction, you know, like you said, there's, you know, some belief that it's grounded in fact.
Well, I think you can be taken in by that. I mean, I wonder how many of those statements I sort of subconsciously think are true.
Right. I think that's part of why in the beginning I thought it was confusing, because I did start looking up some to find out whether they were real or not, whether they were true, and then finally discovered, well, some are and some aren't. I don't think it bothered me. I actually thought it was part of just what I loved about his creativity, because to me it sort of laid the groundwork that this book is has both historical legitimacy and sort of a fantastical feeling. I mean, so there's that blend of the history and the fiction, nonfiction and fiction, which I kind of liked just because it was kind of unique.
I think there are places maybe where it would be almost dangerous, like the chapter where he presented a number of reactions from, I remember, the La Crosse newspaper and various other things, reactions to President Lincoln and whether people liked him or hated him. So that, I mean, the comments about whether his eyes were blue or brown and the disagreement among the commentators about that or how long his nose was, that seems fairly insignificant to me. But I guess if we start to credit the way the public was responding to him, that could be dangerous.
So I guess I will say that I agree that personally, I mean, I enjoy that type of creativity. I enjoy the Underground Railroad just because I thought, what a clever idea. Same thing with Lincoln and the Bardo. However, I just think that the idea that other people, you know, and they say that too about people who watch movies that are based on historical events, but of course they take artistic license with them, then they start believing that those are the facts. And I think that it behooves all of us, I think, to be a little better informed.
And I do think on the Underground Railroad, which you mentioned, that's sort of a much more dangerous misconception. I mean, the entire book is based on the fact that this railroad was real, physical, when it obviously wasn't. That would seem to be a rather huge misunderstanding if people believed it.
Judy, Judy on my right. There's two Judys here, one on either side of me. You're bringing out the point that there were a lot of sections where just one after another, different sources sharing different, totally different perceptions of reality. His eyes were blue. His eyes were green. The moon was bright. There was no moon. And that just sort of points out what you're saying, Judy Getty, about fake news. I mean, we have to take all of it. I mean, we just can't take any of it word for word.
Right.
Well, it's a little like the concern now that eyewitness accounts in criminal proceedings are very misleading and often very misleading and lead to convictions that should not occur. So it might also just say something about our perceptions of, or people's perceptions of reality.
Yeah, I think
reality.
It says something about perception and about how memories are malleable.
Exactly.
And so we think that we have experiences and it's like a videotape in our mind, but, you know, the research now on memory is showing that we modify our memories all the time and modify them through retelling. So if you've just joined us, this is Radio Book Club, and we are talking about Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders. My guests are Melissa Benke and Judy Donegan. I was probably a third of the way into the book before I even thought, what the heck is a Bardo?
Yeah, me too.
Okay. I mean, I don't know why it never occurred to me in looking at the title. What's this Bardo thing? So then looking that up, you know, then a lot makes sense, right? So the definition of Bardo is in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a state of existence between death and rebirth, varying in length according to a person's conduct in life and manner of or age at death. So, as I mentioned, and kind of what the plot or the gist of the story is, Willie Lincoln has died. And so now Willie Lincoln is in this cemetery, and he's surrounded by a bunch of other people. And this, okay, we have to explain, too, that these people do not know they're dead. They think they're sick. And so they're in this in-between place, and they do not know that they're deceased and they're never going back to their other lives. Let's talk a little bit about why Willie's age is important. What's the important part about the age in a Bardo?
I think the innocence of a child. That was really my best guess about that.
I found that whole thing a little ambiguous. I read somewhere that this isn't exactly like the Tibetan Bardo in the sense that that's between death and rebirth. Do we know what happens to these people after they discover they're dead and they pass on? And I never did understand exactly why, I mean, maybe I missed it, but exactly why the trainer girl as well as Willie were in such danger in the Bardo. They don't have baggage like Hans Vollmer or Bevins do, of things that they carry with them into the Bardo from their lives. I mean, Willie doesn't have, maybe it is just innocence.
Well, at one point, Bevins, one of the main ghosts, says these young ones are not meant to tarry, and they give example of lots of children that they saw who were only there for minutes or days, Yeah, I have to think back to, there's one girl, Miss Trainer, who has a horrible, horrible experience there in the cemetery, kind of gets caught there. And because Willie doesn't readily go on either, he stays, he's sort of going to get caught as well.
Talk about, like, there's this breakdown kind of a consciousness or a personality, and they even take on kind of exaggerated forms. And so with Volman, he didn't have the opportunity to consummate his marriage to his teenage wife, and so his member is large, is what they talk about. And with Bevins, he was a closeted gay, and so he is portrayed as having all these eyes and appendages, and so they think it was because of unsatisfied sexual urges. So, you know, so these people have these kind of breakdowns and almost become monster-like if they stay in the Bardo.
Right.
And so, you know, I guess with a child, because they don't have all those other pretenses or the baggage, like you said, perhaps that, you know, that breakdown occurs very rapidly and in a very destructive way.
Yeah, that's a part I really did not get. I mean, I can deal with ambiguity, I think, but I couldn't find hints in the book, maybe I missed them, as to exactly why were these people like Volman and Bevins clinging so much to staying in the Bardo and refusing to admit that they were dead. Well, I get that part. You know, maybe they want to still be alive.
The unfinished business, you know, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talk about unfinished business.
But as to, I just found all of that rather ambiguous, and so I don't know why children exactly are at more danger.
Well, I think there was the idea that the way you live your life is the way you're going to live the next step of existence. So nobody's going to die and immediately go to heaven. That's the idea, one of the ideas that I got. And so children haven't, they've lived so briefly, like you were saying, that they don't have the baggage to hold them back, and they just more naturally go on to a more spiritual state or something. They don't get caught in that in-between Bardo.
I don't know if you read any reviews. I pulled up a couple, but one that I brought in was from The Atlantic, and it's written by Caleb Crane in March of 2017. And he took exception to this idea that the young people, if they remained in the Bardo, was this carapace that would, grow around them, and then they were surrounded by these damned souls. And I thought, really? I mean, so when you said, Judy, I couldn't make sense of this, that even makes less sense. What's the punishment for a child? Why is the punishment for a child who doesn't leave the Bardo to, you know, now his forever after is going to be living with these damned souls? You're shaking your head. It doesn't
Can't
make sense.
Answer that
no,
one.
No,
I have no,
no
answer for that
and
one.
And that's one of the things I liked about the book. I mean, it really did bring up a lot of interesting issues of life and death.
And what happens
What
to us.
Happens, mm-hmm. And why would you believe what you might believe? So there was really a lot to this book, I thought.
So you're making it sound like it's something that we're supposed to think deeply about, rather than is that just a plot device? Because this guy, I don't think, liked the book very much, but he talks about, hurry, Mr. Lincoln, hurry, save Willie.
Yeah, get him out of here.
Yeah.
Well, as far as a plot device, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but I find it a little jarring that you have a really serious, sad situation where the Lincolns lose their 11-year-old son and President Lincoln is distraught. And at the same time, he's thinking about the war that's being waged out there and all the other young boys that are being killed, along with this comic in sometimes cast of ghosts. And if I'm supposed to take this seriously, I don't like talking about it as ghosts. I mean, are they shades or spirits or something makes it more serious? But it's a little hard for me to reconcile the two aspects of this book.
And that's what I loved. I love the humor. I mean, there was a lot of humor in this. I mean, some of it was dark. I guess a lot of it was dark. But that combination of the... it's almost like you can... I mean, I don't know. Are we supposed to take it very seriously? I don't know. But there are issues you can delve into and think about deeply, I think, if you want to. And maybe it's easier. Well, it's easier for me to, because then there's the lighter side. I mean, I just found myself laughing out loud.
You would like the audiobook then.
Okay.
Yeah, because in the reading of it.
Well, that's an interesting thing about the audiobook. I always used to find, I don't read plays much. I don't like to read plays. But when I did, I never quite imagined what the characters were doing very well. And I also never, the inflection and the way these statements were read, they were so much better than the way I read it when I myself. It's like sometimes I'd almost stop and think, wow, I wouldn't have, that puts a lot more meaning in the sentence than I got out of it. So I recommend the audio.
Okay.
Judy, you touched on this a little bit, but we're talking about the spirits or the ghosts that they believe that they're sick. So they refer to their coffins as their sick box. And then it's this sense that, yeah, and it's not like they talk necessarily about when I get back or when I get well, but it's this kind of constant, you know, referring to the sick box and not, you know, you definitely get the sense that they are not accepting that they're deceased. So why did, what's the purpose in that, do you think? What was Saunders trying to say?
Well, they saw their bodies, but they also felt like themselves. And they became, resolved to stay. It said several times that it took work for them to stay. I think on one level they knew they were dead, or some of them knew it, but they denied it.
Reverend Thomas knew, I think.
Yeah, later on in the book we found out.
We talked about him, so that's the third major voice in the story, yes.
The one that we know the least about, I think, as far as we don't know what he did in life to cause the look of terror that often was on his face.
Did you almost get the sense that he might have been a Calvinist? Because this idea that he wasn't one of the chosen, even though now that there he is and he's preached that still when he arrived, and he's the only one that we get this glimpse of this sorting that happens. And so the doors open and it's either this feast or it's a scene from, you know, Dante's Inferno. And so he's going to end up in a hellish place. And so he runs away. And remains in the Bardo.
Yeah, are they afraid of what comes next? But that's how it seems different from Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, if you're going to be reborn, to me that seems positive. Purgatory, the Catholics' purgatory, isn't that what you have to do to pay penance? I'm not Catholic, but to pay penance on your way to heaven. So why wouldn't you want to get through the Bardo and out? Why would you be fighting to stay there?
Well, I think they were hanging on to life. It was work, because they found they had to keep telling their stories, their life stories, to each other or thinking about them. So they loved life. They didn't want to be dead, and so they denied it, and they just they wanted more time to think about and hopefully get back. Although they didn't think that they had left life.
There's this mind problem there.
Very complicated.
Back to what this critic said, because I thought, you know, sometimes when we work with people and we're asking them to think abstract thoughts, you know, in this book, it's pretty abstract. But this author, or this critic, seems to have problems with abstraction because he says, it's awkward, too, that the outcome of the novel hinges on whether Willie can acknowledge in time that he's dead. A character's struggle to accept the death of a loved one would be affecting, as would a character struggle to face up to his own imminent death. But mercifully, no human being on Earth will ever need to accept that he is dead. But that's the basis of the story, you know, that all these people need to accept that they are dead. And the critic seems to have a hard time just thinking that that's just a what-if possibility. What if, you know?
But he doesn't know. Maybe that is what happens. No one knows.
We don't know. That's crazy.
I somehow think this is not what happens. But the... You know, the title, I read one critic who said that, you know, you look at the title and you say Lincoln and the Bardo, and you think it's President Lincoln, right? This critic assumed that it was Willie. So, I mean, in a way, what we have, that is kind of an interesting concept, that the living person is, and President Lincoln in this book has no idea what all these ghosts are doing. He only knows his son is dead. So I thought that was an interesting sort of another ambiguity. Who is in the Bardo?
And that's part of the title. You can make an argument for both of them.
Right. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
They're both in kind of an in-between place.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Because I was also always thinking that it was President Lincoln, but it is... The title might really be referring to Willie. I mean, Willie is the one who is in the main Bardo.
Literally.
That the yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Lincoln is there with him in a sense, for sure.
And Willie is the one who turns everything around by accepting his death. Suddenly people start going off at this matter-light phenomenon or whatever and
yes.
into whatever's next.
So we've talked about the audio and all the different voices, and of course, you know, when you read the book, you see all of the different characters or individuals. Were there any that you liked better, or some your favorites?
Well, this might be a surprise, but some of my favorites were Eddie and Betsy Barron.
Mine too.
Mine too.
Yeah.
Oh no! What does that say?
What
about
does
us?
That say?
Yeah. And what's even funnier, because on the audio, they have some of the best voices.
Oh.
They sound so. I don't even know what to say. White trashy.
Well, they are. But in the book, so why does Saunders not write out? They speak in obscenities, mostly, for people who don't
and
know
And on
that.
The audio, it's
they say it.
Oh. It's not like
yeah,
fudge.
Because you would not be able to say SH blank.
Right. Asterisk.
Yeah, right. So they do say the words.
Mm-hmm. I think the way he does it in the book, the way he writes it with just the first initial of the word and then a blank, there are so many of them on the page. It's just visually very humorous. And then reading it, it just cracked me up.
They are hilarious. And at the same time, they have regrets, too, about their life. Because
they're terrible people.
Well, they're terrible people, and they were terrible parents, but they don't understand why their children don't come to visit.
But then they have
I mean, how typical is that?
Yes, they'll be like, well, you know, we were terrible, so no wonder they don't come to visit us. And then pretty soon they're right back at, you know, where are they?
Yeah, right. Why
ungrateful.
Yes, really. They were hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so funny.
That's so funny that we all agree on that.
And then they're friends with another person's story that I liked, and I'm sorry I didn't write down the name, but he's telling his tale, and he'll stop, and he'll forget it. So this is, again, another aspect of the Bardo, that they have to tell their tale over and over and over again, and it almost becomes like a rehearsed or memorized set. And so he's telling a story, but he would, like, stop, and then it's Betsy or her husband who kind of fill in, and then you went to...
Yeah, that's yes. Right. They do help him along.
Mm-hmm.
Another character I like, though, is the slave, Thomas Havens. And I think that illustrates, and as well as the Bowers do, that, like, typical things. And he talks at some point about being a slave and how he had a wonderful yellow house and he was never sold. And he was treated very well. Well, of course... the master might have come and demanded that he do something when he was in the middle of making love with his wife or something. So by the end of his statement, he has realized that, he felt free at some point, but many people felt free all the time. So he started to realize what his life was like, even though he had apparently rationalized it to think that it was fine as a slave.
Yeah, that was a really powerful, powerful section.
And even though the Bardo certainly seems like an unpleasant place to be in many ways, I was just thinking about it would certainly be very interesting. Because, of course, this is a cemetery. And of course, the year is 1862, and many of the individuals maybe are recently dead. But, of course, they come from different time periods.
Right.
And so when part of the funny stuff is, president, who's president? And then they, you know, it's like, you know, Pierce is president, or, you know, they have from their own time period. And so their reflections are just different.
Yep.
And let's talk a little bit about, because there's, you mentioned Thomas Havens is one of the deceased slaves. So we have blacks and whites in the Bardo. And so what are some of the differences and you know, what's going on for them in the Bardo?
Oh, well, one person there is Lieutenant Stone, and he was horrible. He was a racist. He owned slaves. He called them shards, for they were indeed dark as night, like so many shards of coal, which did give me abundant heat. I need only seize a shard lass up, and ignoring the cries of her shard man would, and then someone else interrupts him, but that was very interesting, the way Stone talked about shard.
We'll come back to that. I want to identify who we are and what we're doing. If you've just joined us, this is Radio Free Palmer, 89.7, and you're listening to Radio Book Club. We're talking about Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. And my guests are Melissa Benke and Judy Donegan. And this is Judy Getty. So we're talking about the blacks and the whites in the cemetery, and that lieutenant, yes, horrible. You know, he forces them back into certain sections of the cemetery, won't allow them to come into certain areas, and then, yeah, and refers to them as shards.
But, yeah, there are all classes of people there. Rich, poor, slaves, slave owners.
But there was the idea of the fence, and that the blacks were more comfortable congregating towards the fence. So I thought, I wonder if the fence is the barrier that, you know, typically they're not allowed to go beyond.
I wasn't sure about that. Another thing I wasn't sure about. Was that the black part of the cemetery, that they were there? Because I would expect that in 1862, the cemetery was probably segregated as well.
Certainly.
Right.
But our favorite couple was buried in a mass grave with the blacks. So.
Yes, they were really down there.
Let's talk about the three main characters a little bit. Roger Bevins the third, which in the audio is David Sedaris.
Oh, nice.
And then Hans Volman is Nick Offerman. Does the reading, and I don't remember who did the reading for Reverend Everly Thomas.
I think that's Saunders himself.
Oh, is it? Okay. And it's interesting because, of course, you know, we've talked about how this is such a serious subject, and at the same time there's these kind of elements of humor added, and so to pick Sedaris and Offerman as readers, I think, is clever also. So when you listen to their stories, and we've talked a little bit about this, but, I mean, does it make sense that they would be in the Bardo? What do you think they're clinging to?
Well, they're probably hoping to consummate the marriage or to finally recognize, as Bevins has vowed, that, you know, he would not stay in the closet anymore. He would not care what the consequences were. So maybe they're clinging to life, hoping they will get a chance to do what they didn't do in life.
Definitely, I think, because Bevins committed suicide, slit his wrist, but then when he saw the blood and everything, he changed his mind, and before he died, he was wanting to live, and so that desire continued on then.
Yeah, for his, it almost makes sense that mm-hmm. he's hoping somebody will find him.
Right.
That's that's what it kind of comes back to mm-hmm. is, you know, I've attempted suicide, but I hope someone comes and finds me and saves me.
Well, and the horrible irony of Hans Vollmer, who married this young girl but promised her he would not require her to be a wife and they would just be friends, which went on for a long time until she decided that it was time to consummate the marriage. So he goes to work and gets killed without ever being able to do it. I mean, there's a really nasty irony there.
Another sadness, yes. Yeah. And then, like we said, we really aren't sure about Reverend Thomas. But I guess some of the allusions in the story that I got was that, you know, he was a preacher, and he kind of preached that damnation thing. And it seemed like an unkind God and a God of judgment. And you know, maybe the message is...
You know, that's sort of interesting because as a preacher, you would think that he would think he was among the chosen and that upon his death he would be ascending
well,
into...
Well, I think that's why when he gets up to that table and sees, oh, I'm going to this hellish place, I'm out of here.
Well, and that's why he has a horrified look on his face, like, whatever happened to me? This was not supposed to happen. I don't know.
Yeah, and then interesting that, so he definitely knew that he was dead, but... I think it says that he was as he was running away, he was instructed to never tell anybody. Mm-hmm. And so he was in the cemetery with all his friends, call it neighbors, couldn't tell them.
Right.
That's right. We talked about the kind of the physical descriptions of Vollmer and Bevins, but with Thomas it was that he had that constant surprised look on his face.
That's right.
Yes. So the other piece of that is... you know, there's so many different elements to the story, but at one part they enter into Abraham Lincoln's body. And while they're in there, they go back to their original appearance. And so it isn't until afterwards that they realize, oh my gosh, you know, Thomas always had that surprised look on his face. So, you know, again, what's kind of the explanation? Why would entering into, you know, their spirits enter into Lincoln's body? He doesn't know that they're there, but they can hear his thinking, feel his emotions. But why, you know, why'd their appearance change?
Someplace I have some notes about that.
I'm glad you do, because I have no answer for that.
Well, they heard his thoughts. They felt his thoughts, so they became aware of so much more than they had been thinking about. And they also heard each other's thoughts when they were all in there together, and it just sort of made their world bigger all of a sudden. They started remembering. They had all these memories flood in.
So do you think it's almost like getting back in touch with their humanity?
Yeah.
Because, you know, again, it's explained to us that the bardo is kind of this deterioration of the consciousness and the personality, and so that they become just these small pieces of themselves, kind of these exaggerated factors that were a part of their lives.
Yeah, because they started remembering all of the good in their lives. They'd sort of been focused on, right, like you say, just these narrow little parts, and it gave descriptions of, oh, just all kinds of things, like our town did. How good a hot bath feels, a good cup of coffee, just all these simple day-to-day pleasures that make life worth living. Somehow that got them back in touch with...
their humanity.
Yeah.
Or their full stories. Yeah.
Is it troublesome that they've been in this cemetery a long time, and they've fought to stay there? Then what about President Lincoln and Willie causes the end of their stay? I mean, what is it about this situation that makes it different from anything else that has happened over the years they've been in the bardo?
because no one else has come in and touched the body the way President Lincoln came in. So he came in, opened up the coffin or the six box, and picked Willie up. I mean, this is what happens in the story. Mm-hmm. And there was talk about that. The ghosts all these years had, people, they'd seen family maybe come to visit, but not really very often. And nobody had touched them. That seemed to play a big part of it. That's what, when that happened, that's when all these other characters that we hadn't heard from before started coming. I mean, just hundreds people that the three main characters hadn't seen before or hadn't seen in a long time. But something about that just drew them all together.
Trying to save Willie, because the reason they entered Lincoln's, President Lincoln's body, was to get him to, what, convince little Willie that he was dead, that he should move on.
Well, they never said that, right. Convince him that he's dead. It was just that he needed to move on.
He needed to move on, right.
We're not accepting the
well, but when Willie finally said he was dead, then they suddenly, it's like, oh, my God.
Then they all.
We're dead, too.
Yeah.
That's right. They were having that awakening then.
So, but, you know, I mean, he uses Lincoln as the vehicle, again, to tell this story. So I guess when I think about how Lincoln is portrayed, and I guess this just seems to be this, you know, the really heartbreaking part of the story, right? That, you know, politically, he's already grappling with this huge issue of sending more and more young men to war and questioning, is this really, you know, is the holding the Union together so critical to cost all these lives? And so he's struggling with that. And then now his child has died, and probably, you know, gave him more empathy for all the people who were losing family members in the war. And so here's this very sad, sad man. And so when they enter him, I mean, to get a sense of that depth of sadness.
Yeah, it was heart-wrenching.
It was, and it's interesting that in such an unusual book, when you get to the end, you get to that part, it really is affecting, I thought.
Some of the passages about the war were really graphic, I thought. Just the descriptions of dead men, dead soldiers, and the horrors of war.
Well, and then his conclusion that basically we have to kill faster to get this over with, because ultimately I guess he decided it was worth saving the Union. Well, Havens enters his body and urges him to do something for us so that we can do something for ourselves. But he decides that, yeah, we have to get this over with, and the only way to get it over with is to kill more soldiers, which was, you know, you can see that the conflict that's portrayed in him and how he comes to that conclusion.
And the president's grief about Willie's death was certainly tied in. I think he was also grieving all the mm-hmm. the men that had died, for sure.
We talked about, you know, that Saunders using some actual historical record and then, you know, making up some. And I guess one chapter I found surprising was when he's using those kinds of sources, or, you know, fabricated sources maybe, some, that really portray him as a horrible person. That the whole, when the night Willie dies, there's this reception at the White House, and so he and you know, Mrs. Lincoln, Mary Todd Lincoln, are, you know, entertaining guests. But at the same time, you know, Mary Todd is running upstairs to check on their son, and he's very ill, and so there, you know, there's this, you know, we're doing our responsibility, our obligation, and at the same time we're worried about our son. But there was a, you know, this chapter that was very critical of him,
mm-hmm.
you know, as if they're downstairs laughing and gay and having a wonderful time, and their son is upstairs dying. It just seems like, I mean, that would be something that you would see, right? I mean, again, that historically, that, you know, that kind of criticism. But I guess the surprising part to me is, I guess, when we have the ability to look back and everything that I read about Lincoln, that wouldn't have been the case.
I'm sorry, that what wouldn't have been the case?
That he would have been, like, not caring or, you know, not worried about Willie.
Yeah, and I think they were worried. I think they both went upstairs. And didn't the doctor assure them that he was getting better, which is why they could go ahead with this party? And then, of course, looking back, when he didn't get better but died, then you say, oh, my goodness, they should not have done that. And then there's some indication near the end that, which other one? Tad?
Tad.
Is also sick.
But might be.
Might be sick, but seems to be recovering.
And I think that's when Lincoln was going through so much guilt over that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was part, just struck me that that's another way he was in the bardo, because he was really suffering at that point. You know, wondering, did they do the right thing by going ahead with the party? And just all the memories of... you know, had he been a good father. And he was really torn whether he was a good father or a good president or a good man. He certainly felt all the criticisms.
Another historical thing about Lincoln, too, is that he did have bouts of depression, that his mother died when he was very young, and so he struggled with depression all his life. So I think, you know, that those pictures of him that are so iconic, that, you know, you just look at this man's face and see the sorrow and the guilt and the struggle.
Right.
So one quote that I had about that, and again, when a child is lost, there's no end to the self-torment a parent may inflict. When we love and the object of our love is small, weak, and vulnerable, and has looked to us and us alone for protection, and when such protection, for whatever reason, has failed, what consolation, what justification, what defense may there possibly be? How do you think Lincoln's sorrow over the loss of his son is mingled with the doubts he feels about the Civil War, is kind of the question I got out of that. Just, you know, trying to do so much. I mean, I think you could just substitute, you know, his thinking about his son in terms, and substitute, you know, the nation.
Right.
Yeah, it's a terrible juxtaposition, really. And shows just how much he had to deal with.
If you've just tuned in, this is Radio Book Club, and we are talking about Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. I'm Judy Getty, and my guests are Judy Donegan and Melissa Benke. We talked about how, you know, we don't know, and people carry with them their own beliefs, perhaps, about an afterlife, or if you're maybe an atheist, this is it, and that's all there is ever going to be. So I don't know if you want to share any of your own thoughts, but, you know, did reading the book make you think about an afterlife differently? Or?
For me, it just made me remember to cherish every day, because we don't know what happens next, if anything happens next. And for me, one of the themes of the book was the important thing is loved, and to love and to know that we're loved.
Yeah, I think that that is part of it. Like, live now. Maybe that's it. You know, live now and be loved now. I guess I don't often think of an afterlife, and this did not really, because it was so fantastical. In my mind, it did not cause me to think about it any differently, I guess. You know, it's another subject, but you were talking about that quotation. One of the quotations I loved in this book, it was about Willie as this remarkable child that the Lincolns did love, and that he was the kind of child that all people hope their children will be before they have children, which in that little sentence says a whole lot. You know, like, imagine we're going to have these wonderful children, and they don't always turn out to be quite perfect. But no, as far as that was off the subject, sorry.
No, I think it leads into it, and I'll just to backtrack a little bit. I agree with you, Melissa. Not that I have any sense of, well, what does the afterlife look like, or is there an afterlife? But I love to entertain the ideas of it. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think that's what Saunders presents us with, mm-hmm. is here's one possibility.
Right. One thing that I liked was that as the ghost transformed to go on, they flickered through all their various selves that they had been as a child, different stages of their life, and then through various future forms that might have been. And I loved that concept. It's like it just it gave me a sense of hope, you know. And I think as we age, many of us yearn for a sense of hope or hope that there's an afterlife. But I really like that image.
So those people that were cheated, they still had
right.
Here's what your life looked like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And maybe going on, that is what happened for them. I mean, that you are do have that full, satisfied, eternal life.
And what you said, too, kind of fit with this, because it says that George Saunders described the question at the core of this book as, how do we continue to love in a world in which the objects of our love are so conditional?
I had trouble. I had read that quotation, and I have a little trouble reconciling that with the book, actually. And I have a little trouble, if that's not the theme, then what is the theme? So I'm still kind of unsure about all of that.
Well, I think it pertains specifically to Lincoln's feelings for his son.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a parent's feelings for a child would certainly, translate to that. You know, how do we continue to live in a world in which the objects of our love are so conditional? Or modern times, I suppose people would talk about, marriages breaking up or, relationships that don't last. And so why do we even put in the effort?
Because that's what makes life worth living for.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
You just had a stunned look on your face. You had a Reverend Thomas look on your face. What? Well, I think we would recommend the book.
Definitely.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so I want to thank Judy and Melissa for joining me to discuss Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders. In August, we will be discussing White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America by Nancy Eisenberg. In her groundbreaking history of the class system in America, extending from colonial times to the present, Nancy Eisenberg takes on our comforting myths about equality, uncovering the crucial legacy of the ever-present, always embarrassing, if occasionally entertaining, poor white trash. My guests will be Pat Chesbro and Paul Thomas. I also want to remind listeners that 89.7 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you, so please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading. Mm-hmm.